It's the weekend, and so what that means is another episode of the podcast is dropping. This week, I interview a thoroughly wonderful human being, Katarina Polonska. And on her Facebook page, she says that she helps successful entrepreneurs and executives become as successful in their relationships as they are in their careers. And Katarina has a really interesting resume. Besides for attending the University of Oxford, as well as the University of Nottingham and Cambridge, she's also a transformational coach, an NLP practitioner and coach, and the founder of the behavioral science of attraction-based Ultimate Match Method. And so in this interview, you're going to get a little bit more information about her journey to where she is now and what she's doing. Suffice it to say, she's really created this place for high-performing people to find love, to find companionship, to find relationship. Because at the end of the day, unless you want to be alone, life is so much better hanging out with someone that you love, someone you can go to the movies with, someone you can share your life with. This is a conversation that struck me because Katarina brought up something that very few guests have, and that's the idea of surrendering. And I really hadn't heard it talked about in this way, but as you'll hear, Katarina's journey absolutely called for surrender. And in the end, well, you'll hear about it as she talks about it. So without further ado, here's episode 159 and my conversation with Katarina.
So I was previously engaged and it wasn't going well. The relationship wasn't going well. And the wedding was coming up and I felt so much pressure of, do I stay or do I go? And there was going to be, I had to convert religions to be with him, which I didn't do. But it was a very, very kind of loaded situation. And there was a lot of things that weren't going right. A lot of things not going right. I mean, infidelity was involved and it was really hard and I didn't know what to do. And I felt so scared and so trapped. And it was COVID and I was all alone. I didn't have family around and kind of time was ticking. And I remember it came down to surrendering again. It honestly, like the irony is that's when I really began to pray.
I would love for you to introduce yourself to my listeners, tell them a little bit about you, who you are, your journey, and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. What a question. Where to start? So I'm a high-performance relationship coach to executives and entrepreneurs, though really I work with kind of any ambitious, high-performing professional. And what that means is that I work in the space where people who are busy, successful, have their careers together, for the most part, you know, they have their finances in order, they have a nice home, they have their friendship circle, they've got their health and that's going well. And the one thing that isn't going well is their relationships. And that's something that I saw a lot of very organically. I was an executive coach before, coaching founders and executives. I mean, I come from a behavioral science background and there's a whole kind of story around that. But when I started out in my coaching practice and I was doing executive coaching and working, like I said, with founders, and originally I started out by working with problems like anxiety, burnout, stress, you know, kind of the big like founder challenges. And what I found as I began to drill down in these problem areas was that there was a lot of loneliness at the heart of everything. Right. And it was either loneliness because they were married, but actually they felt very alone in their struggle. They felt very alone in their startup or alone in their work and their grind. And their partner just didn't understand. And actually the marriage is falling apart. or they felt lonely because they were actually single and they're on a plane 24/7. You know, they're at investor meetings, they're presenting, they've got a really exciting life, but no one to enjoy it with. And they're really struggling. And as a couple of my clients have said, it's lonely at the top. And there's kind of a third piece to it too that I kind of want to call out. And that is something that I didn't think I'd see, but it's something that has come up time and time again. I think when we are so busy and we are building our careers and we're so in the professional sphere, we often, you know, and we're doing a lot of personal development in that space, we often lose sight of the personal development and the growth in the relational space, in that personal space, right? Because almost everything that we do professionally has to have like an ROI. There has to be a value at the end of it. So even like learning about influencing people or learning about time management and communication, it's all very corporate. And I would go so far as to say that a lot of the corporate soft skills that we're learning can actually hinder our personal soft skills, right? Like what it takes to build a true intimacy. And so this is the problem that I'm solving. And I never thought I'd be here, but here I am doing this work kind of very, very accidentally, but I absolutely love it.
You know, I always love asking my guests this next question because it's so fascinating to kind of understand who they were as children. And if they kind of were like, oh, I kind of want to do that when I get older. You know, when you were a kid, did you think that you would study behavioral science? I mean, was it something that you were curious about, like people and how they operated in the world and how, what caused them to react to certain things or not react, how they engaged with certain topics or others? Was that something that intrigued you as a child?
Yeah, great question. I think it did in many ways. I think I always wanted to be a vet. I love animals. I love animals so much. I always wanted to be a vet, but then when I realized I had to put animals down, I was like, can't do it. But yeah, I was always interested in psychology. And actually, I was always interested in gender dynamics. So looking at gender, I mean, so this is a big part of my work. But I was really interested in gender and I was interested in psychology. And I went on to study kind of social sciences through my academic career. But I did my first coaching qualification when I was 17, because my dad is a coach as well. And my dad is a kind of a speaker and does a lot of speaking engagements. So he, when I was going through my own personal challenges, that insomnia, I actually had anorexia as a teenager. Rather than bundling me off to therapy, my parents were like, we'll just teach her how to cure herself and put her into a coaching qualification, which is ridiculous now. And like totally, I mean, I'm glad they did it. I don't know how good parenting that is, but it was great because I learned a lot of really good skills. And yeah, I was able to kind of pull myself out of it pretty powerfully. And then I discovered like somatic therapy and somatic coaching and all of this incredible healing stuff. So it really was from that darkness, from that place of anorexia, that my own personal interests in, you know, behavioral science and looking at gender, that I was like, okay, well, if I'm anorexic and I'm a teenager, and it came back when I was in my 20s, I really got interested in, okay, what is the femininity, the toxic femininity that's driving this behavior? How do I get myself out of this behavior? And really it was that kind of combination of the two. And that's when I eventually started working in the field of behavioral science professionally full time and working kind of more in the corporate space. And then as I did more and more of that, I was like, I really want to work on the personal issues. You know, the corporate stuff is a little bit too dry for me. I want to be working on that personal matters of the heart, matters of the body, matters of the soul. And so I left corporate to build my own practice.
That's actually fascinating. I have to confess something to you. Mm-hmm. I'm endlessly curious, and my dream, if I just had oodles of money, would be to go to school for the rest of my life. I'm mm-hmm. currently trying to figure out how to live in like the Maritimes for an extended period of time while going to graduate mm-hmm. school again. Mm-hmm. But one of my dream schools has always been Oxford. You know, I don't know if I'm in love with Philip Pullman's ideas, like over there, or the, you know, your amazing shows where someone's always solving a murder in Oxford or whatever it is. It is just, you know, when you see it on the TV or wherever you're watching, It seems like a gorgeous place. Plus, yeah. I'm really in love with architecture, but also like the history in that architecture, mm-hmm. like all mm-hmm. of the stories and people and that those stones have been witnessed to or the streets. And so are you in love with it as much as I am? Or am I just, I'm projecting on you, aren't I? I'm projecting.
No, you're not. I'm having my, I'm having the big wedding. We call it the big wedding in Oxford with my husband who didn't go there. But I'm like, why wouldn't I want a Harry Potter experience, right? Like I grew up with the books, and I have to say, I think that my time at Oxford was probably some of the happiest time of my life, which is wild to say, because the work was hard. I nearly dropped out actually in my, in the second semester. So I got a scholarship to go there, fully funded scholarship. It was entirely free. I know. And incredible, incredible achievement. I nearly collapsed when I got the news. I thought it was A, a joke, and B, then I suddenly had all this pressure. I was like, holy cow, Oxford are paying me to study masculinity and femininity and gender dynamics, and I'm the first ever scholar to get funding for this. This is insane. And so that pressure, you know, I took that pressure with me, and then I was like, oh, I don't think I'm being good enough, and I think I have to quit, and I don't think I can do it. But then again, I pulled my finger out and just got on with it and did really well. But it was the most transformative year. I think I've never felt so psychologically safe as I felt there, which I think a lot of people who went there would disagree with me, because it can be quite elitist and competitive. But I was studying, like gender. I was studying a very kind of open-minded, safe topic to be studying. And my own personal experience and the college that I was at, Jesus College, was like the best and most safe, lovely, nerding out, you know, till the cows come home, having a great time in my robe, drinking lots of Prosecco and running around. And my friend used to call it castle hopping, because we'd go to like one bar and it's like a castle, and we'd go to another bar, and we're just, oh, so good. So good. I love it.
You're not doing anything to dissuade me from trying to find some way to get over there.
Oh, you should. I'll do you a tour when you come over.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just because we're talking about it, and you don't have to answer this question, but since you were in school, I would imagine that gender has kind of, that investigation into gender has kind of really changed and gone in directions that are possibly unexpected for you. Would you agree with that?
That's a really good question. And actually something I probably haven't thought about. When I did my Oxford for my master's degree, right? So I was older. So actually it was only about, I mean, what's the math, like 7 years ago that I did it. That's when I went really deep. For my undergrad, yes, things have definitely changed. I remember back then it was like consent was just a thing that we were kind of exploring. And then by Oxford, we were pretty, I remember the cohort I was in was very advanced, like very, very, very intellectually advanced and kind of philosophically open and very fluid. So to that extent, I think if anything, and this is heartbreaking to admit, I think we might have gone backwards a little bit. Because when I think about kind of the whole Andrew Tate movement and the amount of, you know, Jordan Peterson fans out there and kind of the very polarizing rhetorics around gender and how popular they've become, I didn't see that coming, this kind of almost backlash. I really didn't see it coming. I thought the backlash was over naively. I didn't think that it would come back so strong as it has since last year.
Well, the cynic in me says that, you know, who knows? And we're just going to use, you brought up Andrew Tate, so we're just going to use him. Like, who knows if in his heart of hearts he actually believes this, or if it's just a persona that he's curating mm-hmm. to get money and influence and fame. You know, I really believe that so many people are so enchanted and obsessed with being famous these days that they'll do and say whatever it takes to kind of, you know, become an influencer in the world. And, you know, I just thought it was so fascinating when I was a kid, because I'm older. No. You know, they would say, what are you going to be when you grow up? And, you know, I was like, oh, I don't know. I had a list or whatever. But a few years ago, they asked kids what they wanted to be. And like 98% said influencer. And I thought to myself, I don't know if that's just a, says something about their age or the age group, but everybody wants to be famous. And so, you know, I look at these people who really try to curate and cultivate tribalism and us versus them and the other. And I think to myself, yeah, but is that real? Is that true for your soul? Yeah. Is that something or is it just a way to get money, influence, you know, fame? But yeah, I'm a little cynical about these people who really utilize tribalism to win things, whatever it is, money, fame. So
yeah, it would never dawn on me that anyone would make up this persona. I think I just, like, honesty is one of my core values, right? So I'm like, of course you're what you say you are. But sure, yeah, maybe. I mean, that is absolutely horrifying. There are so many different personas that you could adopt to get yourself fame. I mean, chop your legs off and put them on your head. I don't know, whatever you want to do to be famous, but don't do that, right? Don't get arrested in Romania for trafficking. Like, really?
Well, I am inherently lazy, so that getting arrested in Romania seems like way too much work. So right? I would never go there. Well, my second question always is, like, did you grow up in a religious household, or what did that look like for your family as far as, like, belief systems or how they engaged with, you know, that kind of larger energy or the universal, however you defined it?
Yeah, great question. It was religious to the extent that there were, like, traditions to follow. You know, I think my mom would identify, I mean, I know she would identify as Protestant, but very, very loosely. I wasn't baptized or anything as a child growing up in Slovakia. Then growing up in England, I went to a Church of England school. My dad, I think he's always been a hybrid. He's Russian by blood, and I think, well, I know he's got Russian Jewish blood. So whatever, you know, whatever you want to make of that. But he's always been pretty neutral and just believing in some kind of spirituality. And I never had religion forced upon me. And I never really even thought that I was that spiritual. It kind of came to me later in life. Like, yeah, going to school, I did, you know, school time prayer. Because in England, you pray, or you used to pray. I don't know how it is now. You used to pray before school and all of this stuff. So I grew up with that, you know, knowing the Lord's Prayer off by heart. And it was only when I really began to, two things. One, going through that kind of personal development journey that I went on in my late teens and early 20s, and learning to meditate and learning to kind of practice embodiment practices and kind of start practicing surrender, because that's what I really had to do to recover from anorexia, was, like, learn to lean into my body, kind of surrender to a higher power and trust. And the more that I started doing that through practices like meditation, the more my spirituality kicked in. And as I kind of healed, it grew, the spirituality grew. And then when I was very, 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 very lucky to live in Vancouver. So I lived in Dubai before that as well. And I was quite depressed in Dubai. I didn't like living there. I really didn't like living there for many reasons. But that also led me to surrender. I remember sitting on the beach and surrendering, and then having this insight that I actually wanted to go back to university and apply to Oxford and change my career. And so there's always, like, blessings that came from that practice of surrender. And yeah, when I was living in Vancouver, the final thing I'll say, I was so lucky to live in a place surrounded by so much epic nature and mountains and pine tree forests. And the spirituality there for me is huge. And it's not religious, right? It's this kind of, like, earthly, spiritual, deep energy, this kind of ancient energy that I felt so connected to the extent, you know, that I think my husband and I will probably move back there at some point, or he's never lived there, but I'll move back there. And it's this, yeah, that kind of very spiritual force of something greater than what we know. So yeah, it came with time.
Yeah, I can't wait to get back to England, honestly, because I walked Camino in 2013, which is 10 years ago, and I can't believe it. And I didn't get to Santiago. I walked from southern France to Bayonne in northern France. And then I thought, oh, walking along the coast won't be so hot. And I started walking along the Spanish coast. It was like 95 degrees.
Oh, God.
And I stopped going to the bathroom, you know, and got so profoundly dehydrated. I had to lay in a hotel in Santander for a week. And then finally thought to myself, okay, I did what I was supposed to do. So I took a ferry to Cornwall and spent 3 weeks in Cornwall. And can I just tell you that that part of the world is just astonishing? And, you know, I was in Tintagel, Marazion, Newquay, Bude, and the really super scary, scary border guard who was on the ferry, you know, as I was getting off on, I mean, he was so scary looking and I had my backpack and everything. And he's like, so where are you? Why are you here? And I was like, I'm going to Newquay. And he just started laughing and laughing. And he's like, all right, you're no threat. So just get on in. Cause you have no idea what you're talking about. So I've never experienced such welcoming and love and kindness. But honestly, that part of the world is so wild and so beautiful. I just thought to myself, you know, and in Tintagel, like old gods are just so palpable there. Wow. It is astonishing. And I kind of feel that way. I mean, I haven't really extensively traveled in England, the UK, but it seems like a lot. First of all, it's so beautiful.
Yeah.
So beautiful in so many places, but also green. And I just spent 8 years in Santa Fe, which is like high desert. Yeah. So I just, you know, sometimes have those memories and I think, oh my gosh, it's so lush and gorgeous. And you were talking about Vancouver and I was like, she's not talking about Vancouver, Washington at all. No, she's talking about Vancouver.
Yeah.
You know, which as a side note, my uncle used to be chief engineer of the city of Vancouver. So I actually lived near there. And so would go visit them every once in a while. And it's a gorgeous city and it's beautiful. And the museums and the food, it's fabulous. So if you move back there, I wouldn't blame you. Do you get a chance to go out very often and like travel the rest of England or Wales or Scotland?
This is the thing. So I grew up in England, and when I was 19, I lived in Italy. So I went to Venice and I came back. Then I lived in London for a bit. Then I went to Europe for a few years. And then I went to Ibiza, where I am right now, lived here for a bit. Then I came back. Then I went to Dubai. Then I came back. Then I went to Vancouver. And then I came back and I came here. And I have this like itchy feet where I can't seem to stay in the UK though. And I don't know why that is. I don't know why. And my mother's there, my brother's there, I've got friends there. I love visiting. And I know that there are so many epically beautiful parts of the UK. And I've never been to Cornwall. And I remember when I was living in London and I was telling all my friends, you know, I think I'm moving to Canada. And they looked at me like I was clinically insane. And they were like, Kat, just go to Scotland. Go to Scotland. Why do you have to move to Canada to get mountains and nature? Just go to Scotland. And I was like, I don't know. I just want to go further afield. I don't know what it is, but you're inspiring me to actually go and see it, like really see it properly.
Well, one of the things you must do when you go to, I think it was Newquay, because I know how to say it.
Yeah.
They have this thing called co-steering. And so you put on a wetsuit. Have you heard of this? And you go out with these like really young guys who are super fun and chill and cool. And they take you on this adventure for several hours. And we did everything from swim into a sea cave when the tide was down to jumping off. I mean, not high cliffs, jumping off cliffs into the ocean, kind of puttering around in the ocean, swimming into different things. It was so fun. And it made me feel young and cool. And
wow,
it was just, it's cold, that hence the wetsuit. But you know what? You can't help but be like infected by their energy and just how excited they are by the world. So definitely check that out. Because, and also Tintagel, like I'm still trying to get over the fact 10 years later that you can just, I walked from Tintagel out to this place called St. Nectan's Glen, and you just walk through farmers' fields. Like they like open, it's like you climb over these stiles and you just, and they're like, oh, right of way, walk across our fields. And
wow,
but it's really beautiful. So I urge you to do that.
Thank you.
Well, I would love to hear a story where, you know, you feel like you either witnessed or you experienced something that was magical or miraculous, something that maybe changed your life, or you've talked a little bit about that, but anything that you feel like might inspire other people.
Yeah, I think it's kind of harking again back to another dark period of my life. And it wasn't that long ago, it was a couple of years ago. And I was, I won't go into too many details. I was previously engaged and it wasn't going well. The relationship wasn't going well. And the wedding was coming up and I felt so much pressure of, do I stay or do I go? And there was going to be, I had to convert religions to be with him, which I didn't do. But it was a very, very kind of loaded situation. And there was a lot of things that weren't going right, a lot of things not going right. I mean, infidelity was involved and it was really hard. And I didn't know what to do. And I felt so scared and so trapped. And it was COVID and I was all alone. I didn't have family around and kind of time was ticking. And I remember it came down to surrendering again. It honestly, like, the irony is that's when I really began to pray. That's when I seriously began to pray. And every day I was just praying without fail and surrendering and like literally like on my knees, just kind of asking for a sign. And that sign came and then I ended up walking away. And then things still got harder, like my apartment flooded horribly and there was like 40K of damages. And then Ukraine war started. My dad lives in Ukraine. So a lot of kind of horrible things happened kind of month after month. I mean, this kind of happened all over 6 months. And I felt like I couldn't catch a break. And I just remember I remember a friend in Vancouver saying to me, she's like, Kat, you know, I'm worried about your mental health. I feel like you need to do some yoga. And I was just like, you don't understand. Like, yoga is not going to save me here, right? Like, yoga and just taking a break when my dad is in a war zone, like, this isn't going to help. But surrendering did. And the more that I could kind of, I never really understood what surrendering even meant until I kind of fully just let go of all of that control and just leaned in. And yeah, I kind of went, a lot of the things that I ended up doing felt against the grain of what felt comfortable, but they were kind of, it was flowing. It was like unfolding in front of me. And I had to kind of take my ego and put it out the way and just lean into whatever was unfolding in front of me. And it was hard. Like, it was hard for a good, like almost a year. But then when I got to that real kind of like, I'm just going to keep surrendering. That's when I met my now husband at a dance floor at a music festival. And everything shifted because suddenly I was like, okay, I'm going to keep surrendering to this because this is completely bananas. He lives in Canada. I live in London now. How are we going to make this work? It's long distance, but I'm going to keep surrendering to it. And then the slowly kind of things unfolded. And that's when I began to see the light. That's when I was like, oh, I get it. Like, that's why all of these different things happened and all of this stuff had to happen. And it was hard and it was horrible, but here are the lessons that I had to learn. And here are the kind of trials and tribulations that I had to go through and the growth that I've gone through. And now I can see a path ahead. And now I feel like I'm not kind of back in control, but I can see the train that I'm on and it's okay. Like, I like this train and now I'm surrendering to that train, if that makes sense. And so it's almost like, I think when I was first learning about the concept of surrender and reading Michael Singer's book and The Untethered Soul and all of the stuff, in my head, surrendering was like a, you know, quick thing that you just do and it all unfolds and suddenly everything's dandy and brilliant and happy and, you know, you relax. For me, surrendering took like nearly a freaking year and it wasn't that fun, but I felt very clearly, I was like, oh, this is surrendering. Yeah, like I'm horribly out of control here and I don't know where I'm going and I don't know if I like it, but I'm doing it. And it just, it really changed my life. But it all started with that kind of prayer and like throwing my hands up and everyone like, I actually don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Just tell me what to do.
first, I have to say meeting someone on the dance floor is like the best ever, because yeah, I think that's exciting. And you're like, you're presumably filled with joy and happiness, and you're glad to be there. So it's a really good place to be. But I think what's really fascinating about what you just said was, I mean, everybody talks about it now. Everybody wants the quick fix, right? They want something that maybe takes 30 seconds, maybe 5 minutes. But the idea, and you stated it so beautifully, that it was almost as if you had to walk this path, and the path was that year, and not know where the end was or what the end was going to look like. But you opened your heart to saying, okay, I'm open and I'm willing to where this path is going to take me. The other thing you said, which I thought was really, I thought, oh my goodness, you know, when it rains, it pours. You know, honestly, you have this engagement, you break, then your apartment floods, then there's the war. And I thought, oh, can one human have any more like pile on?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you must have felt like, I mean, overwhelmed. And it's like, how do you hold all of these different things that are happening? And then, you know, let alone the engagement ending and trying to heal your heart you know, from that.
You're spot on. It's so interesting how I think, because now I obviously do relationship coaching, right? And that's something I kind of really took away and I share with my clients, is that grief has to be felt. Grief has to be felt. And I think the grief stayed with me for a good year and a half. I think it's probably only in the past 2 months that I've stopped feeling grief about calling off that engagement, which is hilarious because I'm married, happily married now, right? And yet I still feel grief around that. I still have a grief around Ukraine war. I still have grief around leaving Vancouver. And I know why. It's because there was a whole, you know, 8 month period where I was in pure survival mode and just like holding on for dear life on this train going God knows where. And so it really has to be felt. And there's no shame in that. If anything, I think there's real beauty in that, in feeling that grief, because it means, okay, now I can actually stop and breathe and feel the sadness of what passed. And we all deserve to feel the sadness of what passed, right? That doesn't make any sense to be kind of plowing on ahead and putting on a happy face and being happy, happy, happy. No, it's sad when things end. It's sad when there's death and destruction and breakups, and this is all sad. And we owe it to ourselves to feel it.
And the other piece I just wanted to touch on that I'm really grateful that you brought up, because it's so powerful, and I feel like not enough people utilize this, is somatic therapy. I've talked about it a lot on the show with different people, different guests, and just how stories and ideas and grief, emotion can get lodged in the body.
Yeah.
And there are so many different ways of accessing it or working with it. You know, whether it's acupuncture, massage, or somatic therapy or talk therapy, and every person's going to be different to access that kind of stuff and start making it more malleable so that you can release it. And so I guess, because I'm endlessly curious and into this, what kind of somatic therapy do you really love that works for you?
Yeah, great question. Great question. And yeah, I think I discovered somatic therapy without even knowing it was somatic therapy, because my original somatic therapy started as movement. So I was on a retreat. It was called the Hoffman Process, one of the best retreats I've ever done in my life. And it was all about kind of moving and shaking and like expelling that energy and, you know, like punching it out and like getting it like physically out. And at the time, I don't think I really understood what was going on. But now I understand. I'm like, oh, I was feeling whatever I needed to feel, expelling it out of the body, like an animal would shake its body off, right? After a trauma, after like a fight or flight response. And so I was doing that, found that incredibly helpful. And honestly, I don't think I do it enough. I don't think many of us do it enough, because we're sitting here behind our desks, you know, we're not really kind of shaking our bodies and getting wild. And sure, you might go to ecstatic dance, but like not many people do, right? And so that's kind of one of the things. The other thing that I think is really interesting is I actually found somatic therapy, in terms of obviously like working with a practitioner, to be really helpful, but also like just your, my own meditative practice. That's one of the things that I teach my clients, which is you don't have to pick up a baseball bat, you know, to expel your anger. You can feel it when you're in a meditative pose, and you can hold the pose of anger in your body as you are meditating and use the power of your visualization and your mind to kind of expel it that way, right? Like somatic is, the mind doesn't know the difference between reality and what we're imagining. So somatic's kind of an ongoing embodied experience, and anything can be done intentionally, right? So I think, yeah, one of my favorite, final thing I'll say, like one of my favorite ways of processing a trauma or beliefs or whatever it might be that we need to kind of expel and transmute is literally just staying in a meditative position and visualizing myself in that pain point or in that situation and allowing the feelings to kind of permeate through my body and just letting myself feel them and then giving myself a little quick shake off. But I'm not, you know, jumping off the walls or anything. It's quite subtle, but very powerful.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Some scientists say that an individual cell is the smallest unit of human consciousness. And I think to myself, you know, I'm comprised of trillions of units of human consciousness, I guess, if you want to talk about cells in that way. And I'm pretty sure those cells, even though they die and regenerate over and over, that I always say, this is so cheesy, don't judge me or laugh at me, but I'm like, my cells are in it for me to win it. You know, they want me to succeed. They want me to divest myself of these stories that don't serve me, that make me sick or make me sad or make me sorrowful. Because at some point, like, it's going to be too much for them to carry. And they're going to be like, I'm overwhelmed. But I do believe that our bodies, you know, they want us to exist in the state that's full of joy, that's full of happiness and contentment and enthusiasm for the world. And so I'm so grateful to you for articulating all that and for embodying it. Because once again, my mind goes back to you on that dance floor, right? Mm-hmm. After all of this surrender, and here you are with your body and all those cells on that dance floor, dancing in this place of joy, and you meet your husband. And, and what more perfect story is that?
Totally. And you're spot on. And a place of surrender. A place, like, I keep banging on about it. And again, this is something I talk to my clients. It's like actually the final stage of my program, which is that you will feel when you are surrendered. Now, you can think you're surrendered. You can fake surrender. You can, you know, kind of rationally be logical about it, whatever. But you will know when you are actually being surrendered. Because I swear, I went to that festival in such a headspace of pure honesty in terms of, sure, I wanted to meet someone. Every single person that goes anywhere is probably looking to some extent to meet someone, right? As a human, it's not normal to say, oh, I don't want to meet anyone. No, of course, like if you do, then you're looking. So I was surrendered to that. I was surrendered to that little vulnerable part of me that secretly was like scanning the crowd and looking. I was surrendered to the fact that I was going on my own to this festival, and I felt a little bit vulnerable, but I was like, it's okay, I'm going to be with myself. I was surrendered to the fact that I hated the corporate job I was in. I hated it, but I was like, yeah, I hate my job, and I'm just going to go and show up and surrender to this experience and have fun with the moments that I have and the music that I have and make nothing of this situation other than I'm just here for it, and what will be, right? And that's a very different energy to kind of the fake shaman surrender, right? Which is when you are walking around in like a kaftan and like, you know, whatever. Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. That's very different.
Babies, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Katarina. There will be a link to her YouTube in the episode show notes, as well as a link to her website. Katarina reminded me that surrendering is both an active and a passive process, in that you have to intentionally and mindfully kind of let go and surrender your life to the path that you're supposed to be on, while also kind of passively being in the moment, kind of in this meditative state, so that things can happen for you and through you. At least that's the way I understand it. you yourself can understand it in a different way. And as long as it gets you on the path that you feel like heals your heart or helps your heart or reminds your heart that this world is an enchanting place and that we're all co-creating with reality, it's all good. I'd like to thank you all for listening to this episode of the podcast, and I'd like to thank Katarina for being willing to be a guest. I need to thank Sasha End for all the music that's in this episode, and complete attribution will be in the episode show notes. Thanks to everyone who shares this podcast. Please go out, let everyone know what a fabulous podcast it is. If you see someone who's having a hard week and a hard day, say, hey, I have the perfect medicine for you. It's this podcast called Bite-Sized Blessings. It might remind you that this world is a beautiful place, because we all need reminding every once in a while that there are good things in the world, that there are good people in the world, and that each of us can create our own magic. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Katarina. Surrender to your life. Surrender to your process. Surrender to what your soul wants, because in the end, the soul does know what's good for us and the path that we should be taking. And in the end, I suspect that if you do surrender and you let things happen the way they're supposed to, I bet you'll be on a dance floor sometime, dancing your heart out, jumping up and down, reveling in how beautiful this world can be. And maybe, just maybe, you'll find something on that dance floor that you've been searching for all along.
I kept thinking, she needs a t-shirt that says, don't fake surrender, and you should wear it around.
I love that.
And you're like, hey, what does this say? Don't fake surrender.
I love that. I actually will get that made.
Take it.